Acts 26 is where we are, Acts chapter 26 and verse 9. In our last textual study, we got partway through that. We stopped because we wanted to talk about the conscience for a little bit. Paul said he felt like he really believed that he needed to do some things which were contrary to the name of Jesus. In the last textual study, I mentioned to you that there are some words in this verse, several words in this verse, which deserve some careful attention, and we've been trying to do that, and we'll do that a little bit more. Let me suggest to you, though, first of all, that as you look in Acts 26:9, you have a strong connection with the previous verse. I mean, we expect that. The Bible is illogical. It's a sequential kind of book. But who's he talking to? Anybody remember? We've got three key people here. There's some others as well, but three specifically are named as far as names. We've got Festus. What's his role? He is the... Felix and Festus, they were both... Who's the head of our state? A single man who... Okay, we've got the governor, right? So Festus and Felix, they were governors. Felix had started out with Paul, now we're over to Festus. We've got Bernice, and we've got the king, and this is King Agrippa. Okay, now Agrippa's the one that's under consideration, and Paul says this in verse 8. He says, "Why is it judged incredible with you," talking to the king, "why do you think it's incredible if God doth raise the dead?" Now, he makes that point, and then he immediately slips over in verse 9 as far as talking about himself. He says, "I verily thought with myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth." So he sort of shifts the attention onto Agrippa and says, "Why do you think it's incredible? Why do you think it is hard to believe? Why do you think it's so unusual, King?" Now, if Paul had not pivoted back to himself quickly, how do you think Agrippa might have felt? Yes. So he could have felt like he was being accused. Any other words that you can put there? But I'm going to put that towards the top of the list. Agrippa might have felt like Paul was accusing him. What else? Agrippa might have felt like Paul was trying to... All right. And we might add a couple of additional words. Embarrass him. Humiliate him. Bring him down a few notches. Now, if you do that to an adult, doesn't have to be a king, how does a person feel? Belittled? Embarrassed? Yes. Feels about that high. So if you're trying to win that person for Christ, your chance of success is going to go up or going to go down. It's probably going to drop like a rocket. And in this particular case, you not only have that consideration, but you have what other consideration as well? Why is this guy here in Paul's case? Well, he's got some influence. He's got some power. Now, Paul's appealed to Caesar, so that sort of kicks it into a different category. But, I mean, you're talking to the king. You want to be respectful to all people, but that's especially true. So I think here you see a stroke of brilliance on the part of Paul. We certainly don't want to discount inspiration either. But Paul makes the point. He kind of puts the king on the hot seat. Do you think it's incredible? Really, I mean, we're dealing with the God of heaven. Do you think it is incredible? Is that really your belief when it comes to a resurrection from the dead? And then Paul pivots back to himself and says, well, I'm just going to take kind of a verbal step back here and say, what about me? Was there a time in my life when I didn't believe in it? Yes. So, King, I'm putting you on the hot seat, but I'm not going to humiliate you. Let's also talk about me for a little bit. So I think that's a great technique sometimes. As far as talking to people about the Bible, we might put them on the hot seat. We can press them. We can push the matter to a certain degree, but you can only go so far sometimes, and sometimes you need to back off just for a bit. Anything that you want to add or ask over that quick point? Okay, let's see what else we've got here. Going back into the text, Acts chapter 26 and verse 9, if you've just joined us. Paul said before he came to realize that Jesus was the Son of God, let's look at the end of the first part, if you divide this verse into half or thirds. He says, I verily thought with myself that what I had. Okay, that's a good translation. I had. What else do we have? Must. Oh, that's even better. The ASV says ought, which sounds like it's pretty important. Anybody have something else? Had, must, ought? Okay, let's stick with the must. When we've talked about the word must before, we've made what point? That little word, day, D-E-I?
It's something you definitely have to do.
It's something that you definitely have to do. Our old illustration is the triangle illustration. Remember, the triangle must have how many sides?
Three.
You can't have a two-sided triangle. You can't have a six-sided triangle. You can't have a one-sided triangle. A triangle must have three sides. Now, this is the word that Paul uses when he describes his opposition to Christ. It wasn't, I thought I could oppose Christ. or this would probably be a good idea. He says, I what? I must. It was, in his mind, an imperative. It was something that absolutely had to be done. And that gives us some insight into his thinking. But he doesn't stop there. He says, I felt like I had an absolute obligation. I had no choice but to do what? To do many things. So there's some people who would say, well, I need to go out and do this and that. But in Paul's case, he said many things. And those many things were contrary to the Christian faith. One source, I'll give you the quote here. He said, Paul's use of both the first person pronoun, grammatically superfluous because it's implied in the main verb, and the reflexive pronoun, that's some technical stuff, graphically highlights personal activity and responsibility for Paul. Now, sometimes a person will say, well, that needs to be done, and maybe that's true. Or a person says that should be done. But there are other times where something needs to be done, and what does a person say? That needs to be done, and who's going to do it? It's going to be me. I am going to do it. I'm going to be the one who steps forward and takes care of that. So you can see Paul, he says, there are things that need to be done as far as this Christ character. There are things that need to be done as far as these Christian people. And who's going to go out there and take care of them? You better know it is going to be me. Now, if that's not your view of Paul the persecutor, that's the view that's being expressed here by himself in Acts chapter 26. So he takes full responsibility for what he did. He does not hesitate to say that he had been a zealous persecutor of the church. And if we try to personalize that a little bit, we can look at our lives and say, well, are we trying to do some things, or in Paul's case, many things for instead of against the kingdom of God? If you are a Christian very long, you will find some people who will live their Christian life and they want to do as little as they possibly can for God. That should not be our choice. We should have a desire to do as much as possible, as often as possible, and for as long as possible. Steve?
I think Paul is bringing up what he used to be like and wants as many people to know that, because if he can come from that, then anybody can come from whatever their circumstances, because he could have kept that all to himself. And unless they were persecuted by him or saw him persecute, they wouldn't know his backstory. But he himself is repeating it.
You're right. And that argument is used today by all kinds of people. They would say, you know, let's just use a star athlete, for example. I didn't grow up being a basketball player, didn't grow up being a football player, but I made it. And you can too. Now, you may not be a sports player, but whatever you think that you might have an interest in, whatever you think that you might be good at, you apply yourself like I did, and you can also be successful. Parents will do that sometimes with kids. So that is still a common argument that is made, and that's the very principle that Paul is using here. I became a Christian even though I was the least likely choice. Agrippa, Festus, Bernice, the other people who were there, you can as well. Excellent thought. Anybody else? Patrice, are you... Yes.
And not say, oh, this needs done. Somebody should do it. We should
take it. It's easy to start looking around and saying, well, who can we get? One person can't do everything, obviously, but to have that attitude, and that can really help move things along in a good way. That it? All right, let's talk about another word. We have the word which is rendered contrary. And again, anybody have a different term there? He says, I really thought to myself I was obligated to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus. Gary?
In opposing to.
All right. That's also good. Anybody else?
Hostile.
Okay, I got about three answers. I'll start with Lois.
Hostile.
That's very good. All right. That's also good. Okay. The word is used elsewhere. It's used in Matthew chapter 14 and verse 24, Mark chapter 6 and verse 48, and also Acts chapter 27 and verse 4 to say that the winds were contrary when it came to sailing. What's it mean? I've always wanted to be out in a sailboat. I had a guy promise when I was in scouts to teach me how to sail, and he broke his promise. I never even got to the boat. And I've always kind of been a little dejected about that. So anyway, I guess it was God's will for me to never get out in a sailboat. See?
Well, with, you say wind's contrary. If you're trying to go west and the wind is blowing from the other direction, you're not going to be able, on a sailboat, you're not going to be able to go that direction.
Yeah. Anybody ever use a trolling motor?
What?
A trolling motor on a boat? Okay, if you have. Now, they've gotten better over the years. But in the old days, if you had a trolling motor, and especially if it wasn't a high-dollar trolling motor, I mean, you're not going very fast. And you get a little headwind, and guess what? You know, you're trying to go this way with your little trolling motor, and you've got, you know, a wind of about 25 knots pushing this way, and guess what happens? You're going to have to get out the oars if you're going to make it very far, because that old trolling motor is not going to do anything. So when you have wind which is contrary to you, or you ever been out in a place, I remember Great Falls. When we were there, it was the windiest city, and I can still remember one day I was trying to walk to work. I think it was cold, it was wintry, it was blustery. You got on this parka that's about 40 pounds, and, you know, for every step forward, you're having to fight for every step against the wind. Anybody ever have that kind of experience? You know, it just feels like, you know, you're going with snowshoes out there trying to, you know, move against the wind, and it feels like it's just blowing you back, and it's really, really tough to walk. And you would think, well, you know, I'm young, I'm healthy, I'm strong, and yet the wind. So this is the image as far as the word contrary. It is that wind which is pushing back. It is the wind which is forceful. It is the wind which is brutal. It is the wind which wants to stop you. And that's one of the words that Paul says, I thought I had to do how many things?
Many
things that were contrary. I had to be like this forceful wind that was trying to beat people back, to stop the spread, to prohibit the push of Christianity. It is a vivid word. It is a powerful word. And if you're trying to explain your former manner of life, as Steve mentioned just a moment ago, it certainly would have made the point. And then we toss in that word that we started with, and that was the word ought or had or must, depending on your version. It is very, very impressive. You have the word being used in 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 15 as well to say that there were men who were so contrary that they offended God, they offended everyone else. So it's here simply a way of Paul saying, I did everything within my power. I used all my ideas. I went all out to a point oppose Jesus of Nazareth. It kind of reminds me, I've never actually seen one, I think, in use, but you pass by a construction site, they've got the big crane, and the crane's attached to a wrecking ball. You just imagine if there were a person at the controls, and he really didn't know what he was doing, or he was kind of careless. You know, can you imagine just swinging that ball, you know, randomly, you know, bang, and take out a car, bang, take out a wall, and bang, you know, take out something here. That is kind of the image that I get as far as Paul. Now, he was not reckless in the sense that he was thoughtless. It looks like he was pretty disciplined as far as his approach to persecuting Christians, but he was like a giant wrecking ball. And we're going to see more about that as we get down to verses 10 and 11. Anything you want to add or ask before I give you a quote? Okay, share this with you. This comes from McGarvey. He said, this part of Paul's defense must have caused Agrippa to say within himself, why the man was once on the side with my family, that would be the Jewish side, Jewish faith, Judaism, and he showed the same zeal to suppress the cause of the Nazarene as did my father, my uncle, and my grandfather. So he's looking at his, perhaps in his mind, he's looking at his family. He thinks my family has opposed Christianity. Paul used to be of that same mind. He's admitting that, and now he's on the other side, and not just a Christian. I mean, he's out there doing as much for it that he used to do against it. And if you are trying to figure this out as far as a court case, what would you be thinking as a judge? Yeah, I mean, you have to either, I think, come to one or two conclusions, and this is what it boils down to. It's kind of like Jesus. He was either a nut or he was the Son of God. You don't have any room in between the two. So Paul's either a crazy man, you know, incapable of figuring out which way to go, or this was a genuine conversion. There's really no middle ground there. Anybody else? Gary?
You know, we sit and we think, why did God choose Paul? Why, you know, but if you find someone that has this much passion for his purpose and you can get his mind to go the other way, and then also, I just all of a sudden think, it's logistics. Like, I've got this guy that's working against me. Let's not only gain a person for my cause, but also get rid of a person for their cause, and so it's a double win. So
yeah, it is. I mean, these are the kind of people I think that a lot of people would avoid. You know, we just will hopefully, you know, not have to ever have him in assembly, and he'll hopefully just stay out of our hair. But if you're really looking for a good and effective convert, this is the kind of guy that you want to seek out. This is the kind of guy that you want, you know, to win for your cause, whether it's religious or not, because he's got the energy, he's got the passion, he's got the zeal, and he's going to be worth 10, he's going to be worth 100, quote-unquote, normal people. And I don't mean that he was abnormal, I just mean as far as his level of commitment and zeal. So yes. Okay, let's go and give you a couple of the things. Let's talk about the end of the verse. Paul, as he is describing this, is, and this is the only time in the New Testament that Paul refers to Jesus in this way. Paul talks about Jesus, and he says it is Jesus who? Jesus of
Nazareth.
All right, let's start with a question. Was Jesus some kind of special or magical name? No. Would you say that it was an ordinary name, a common name, perhaps? It was. Both of those things are true. It was an ordinary name. It was a common name. In fact, in Colossians chapter 4 and verse 11, Jesus is called Justice. So you've actually got another person in the New Testament who is named Jesus. You would also find over in Luke's genealogy, it's I think Luke chapter 3, about verse 29, depending on your translation, you've got in some versions there the name Jesus appearing as well. So Paul is before Agrippa. He's talking about Jesus. Already mentioned the Lord. But now he says, Jesus of Nazareth. Why do you think he says that in the presence of Agrippa? Why add of Nazareth? I'm sorry. All right. I believe that is exactly right. He's specifying it is the one that we are talking about. It's not just any Jesus, but this is the one that I was involved with. This is the one who was involved with your family and so forth. He didn't want Agrippa to think about some other Jesus. The expression of Nazareth occurs about 20 times in the New Testament, and you find about half of those times in the book of Acts. And as I said, this is the only time where Paul identifies a Lord in this way. Now, here's a question that we really can't answer, but do you think that Paul had some knowledge of Jesus? Well, let me add a little to that. Do you think he had some knowledge of Jesus before the Lord died and Jesus' resurrection?
Well, he was in that Jewish faith and they were fighting against him, so I mean, he had to have some knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe.
He'd fight against him if he didn't have any knowledge.
Yeah, you know, Paul had been taught by Gamaliel. You know, he wants to be the Pharisee, the Pharisees, the strictest sect, so you would think that at some point he had at least some knowledge of Jesus. It's interesting to me to consider, was there ever a time or maybe multiple occasions where Paul had a chance to hear Jesus? I don't know. I wonder. Or did he ever have the opportunity to see Jesus perform a miracle? Now, somebody says, well, if he had seen Jesus perform a miracle, he would have believed. Well, really? Don't we have some pretty important Jewish officials who saw Jesus perform some miracles and hear his teaching, and they didn't believe? They wanted to kill him. So Paul might have actually, before, you know, the appearance on the road, might have actually seen Jesus, heard Jesus. There's simply some information that we don't know, but I'm very, very curious. Well, Paul, as he talks about the Lord, he says he not only needed to do contrary things to Jesus, but what do we have before Jesus? Contrary to what? To the name. All right. What would you say that means? Contrary to the name of Jesus. Contrary to Jesus what? To Jesus. All right, I think that's good. I'm going to actually add that. Mission. I missed that one. What else?
Teaching.
All right, his teaching. I think that's good. I'll add that one too.
His cause.
All right. Similar, but still good. Anything else? Well, what about Jesus' nature? What was Jesus' nature? The nature of Christ was both God and man. So if you're going to oppose Jesus, you're going to have to say that he was not God in the flesh. What about Jesus' character? Did religious people like the Pharisees try to assassinate the Lord's character? You are what? You're a blasphemer, and you are a drunkard, and you are a glutton. I mean, there were different things. There were some very serious and evil charges against the Lord. And what about Jesus' authority? If you're going to do many things contrary to Jesus, what about questioning his authority? He has no right. He has no authority to tell you how to live. Who do we go back to and listen to? Moses. That would have been the argument from the Jews. All right, sometimes we say that there is not too much good in anyone or something, but there is some good. when you look at Paul and how he describes himself, things, many things, contrary to the very name of Jesus, the Lord's character, the Lord's nature, the Lord's cause, the Lord's mission, the Lord's teaching, what would you say as far as how much good Paul saw in Jesus? Seems to me it's pretty close to zero. You might say, well, he healed somebody, but if you acknowledge that, you just make the argument of the other Jews, and what do they say? Oh, yeah, he was healed, but he was healed by what? Yeah, he was healed by the power of the devil. So you got your healing, but it came from Satan. And Jesus said that was serious stuff.
And when you say just the name, it's not just the person, but like everybody else that follows along with that mindset, it's just even the mention of the name could be is what he's supposed to be.
Yeah.
So there's no good.
Yeah, it's as if Paul wants to obliterate everything about Christ. Let's just get rid of him. Let's erase him from the history books. Let's just deny his teachings. Let's just deny the miracles that he did. And let's wipe out his people. That was his mission. And yet, when you look at the church, remember Acts chapter 20, verse 28, the church was bought with what? With the blood of who?
Jesus.
So, and you could do, I guess, a whole study on that, but it's kind of interesting to me that Jesus was tolerant of Paul for a long time. He lets him go out and really become involved in the persecution. Paul makes a name for himself. Paul gets well established in that. And Jesus sort of bides his time. And then one day, what's Jesus decide to do? He has a conversation, doesn't he? You kind of filled up your cup of iniquity, as we read about in the Old Testament. And he met Paul and Saul, and that was the day where this man had the beginning of a radical life change. All right, anything else before we look at Acts chapter 26 and verse 10? All right, let's pick up that next verse. And, so he's continuing the thought here. And this I also did where? In Jerusalem. And he says, I shut up many of the saints in prisons, having received authority from the chief priests, and when they were put to death, I gave my vote against them. Several things to unpack here as well. We have the gospel being preached first where? Acts chapter 1 and verse 8. Jesus said, I want you to go where and start preaching? I want you to go to Jerusalem. So Jerusalem becomes sort of a stronghold, at least an early stronghold for the church. And if you're going to begin persecuting Christians, it makes sense to go where? All right, where they are in this particular case. When we had brethren, when Russia opened up well over 20 years ago, we had Christians start out where? At least primarily. Where'd they go?
Russia.
Well, yeah, that's the general answer, but what city?
Moscow.
Why? It's the capital. You've got a lot of people coming in. So if you can establish a church there, kind of like Jerusalem, you've got people coming in for the feast and so forth, and you create a nice, solid group there, and that way when people come to town, you might not actually have to go out and see them. You've got people coming in, maybe be able to convert them. They get the information that they need. They go back home, and they start another congregation. So, brethren, use the strategy that we have in Acts chapter 1 very, very effectively in Russia and other places. Then you have, we remember back in Acts chapter 7, the closing verses in that chapter, starting with about verse 54, going down to the end of the chapter. We've got the information as far as Stephen being opposed, and Paul, he was certainly part of that. He was, at least at that time, maybe not at the forefront of the persecution efforts, but he was at least involved with them. And he says here in Acts 26 and verse 10, he persecuted how many Christians?
Many.
So we don't know the exact number. Does that mean hundreds? Does that mean thousands? Maybe tens of thousands? We simply don't know. But he was definitely committed to that. We also would say, in addition to committing many acts, some of which may have been violent, acts against many saints, the word prison, is it singular or is it plural? It's plural. Now, what's that tell us? I put many saints in prisons, plural. There were at least how many prisons?
Two.
All right, there were at least two. Now, we don't know how many prisons there were in the ancient world. It could have been dozens. I suspect we're probably not dealing with hundreds because, you know, he's working in a limited area. But, again, it was significant by those standards.
Gary? Yes, he said singular prison, but I can't imagine that it's you say prison, everybody knows what a prison is, and there's prisons all over the place.
Yeah. I'll check that. I don't remember a manuscript variation there, but that's interesting. Thanks for bringing it up. Singular. Okay. From what I remember, as far as checking that word, that was plural, but I'll go back and take a look at that. Okay, let's see what else we've got. Paul said he received some authority. If you're going to go out and you're going to be doing this kind of stuff and you're acting on your own authority, might you get into trouble at some point? You could, and maybe you would, depending on how far you go, but especially if you're going to take people off to prison and you're going to do some things in the synagogue. So it's kind of like the police. If they're going to come and they want to search your house, they want to knock down the door, you know, they might be able to get away without what?
A search warrant.
But if they really want to be on firm footing, if they want to make sure that they can get into your house, and if they find something that they can use that to prosecute you, what do they want?
Authority.
All right, they want authority. They want that warrant. They want the badge behind them. And that's kind of what Paul does. And that's why I said before, he's very zealous, he's very passionate, he's going at this with all he has, but he also has enough sense to realize, I need to work with these guys. Whether they reached out to him, that's a possibility, or he reached out to them, or it's kind of a mutual meeting of the minds, we simply don't know. But he did get authority from the chief priest. That would have been the high priest and the other people that would be close to that level. And the authority, you can imagine that since these people were in the area of Jerusalem, that would have been fairly clear cut. He would not have been able to get away with that kind of thing had they not been on board. But sometimes, just like a business, they will say, we've been a local business and we've done well, like a restaurant. Anybody remember, throw out a couple chains here, Big Boys?
Yeah.
Big Boy Restaurant? Okay, they started out, you know, here, kind of like Sam Walton or Walmart. That would be another illustration. You know, you start out here and you got a good store and things are going well. People like the service that you are offering. And then the business owner looks at that and says, well, my Walmart, my Big Boy is doing well, so what am I going to do?
Expand.
We're going to put one down in a city, downstate or upstate a little bit more, and that goes well. And then pretty soon, what happens? Walmart, Big Boy, you're everywhere, all over the nation. Well, if you are the persecutor, and that seems to be going at least okay in Jerusalem, you're thinking that these Christians, now they've scattered, Acts chapter 8 and verse 4, so what do I need to do? I need to take my operation, my persecution operation, and what do I need to do with it?
Expand.
I need to expand. All right, but if you're going to expand, and you're going to go after Jews, and you're probably going to be dealing with the synagogues, what do you need? You need authority. And the authority was going to come from those chief priests. So Paul got that. When you look at the word which is translated authority, it describes a commission, it describes permission, it describes authority, and it's not limited to here in Acts chapter 26 and verse 12. So Acts 26:10, Acts 26:12, those are the only places where we have to use it. All right, let's see, I wanted to give you another crime here, another statement about crime here. I'll give it to you as far as a quote, and then we'll think through it. Paul seems to have implied he was not the only one guilty of sinning against Christians. The chief priests also shared in the crimes against God's people, and the very leadership that now accuses Paul, after he had quit acting criminally, acted criminally along with him. In other words, Paul is going back and saying, hey, you know, I was in the wrong, and he's also indicting the people who are now going after him as far as the charges that had brought him to this particular place. There's another interesting point, I think, here that bears mentioning. When you go back and you start looking at the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and we saw this really well from Acts chapter 23, verses 6 through 10. That takes us back to Lysias. He's trying to get an understanding of things. Paul was being beat on by the crowd, and Lysias arranges to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin had some Pharisees and it had some Sadducees in there. How was Paul able to divide that group? How was he able to get him in what might have actually been a fist fight? He said, I am a son of what? I believe in the resurrection. Now, the Pharisees, when they heard that, what were they thinking about Paul? Well, he must be pretty good. I mean, that's one of our cherished doctrines. We believe that. And if he believes that too, well, you know, we kind of brethren. You know, we can get along with you. The Sadducees hear that, and what's their thinking? He's definitely a bad guy. So there's this huge eruption. Now, bearing that in mind, as far as the distinction between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, how well would you expect them to get along then? I mean, if just this one point of doctrine causes them to break out into what might be a fist fight, you're thinking, can they ever agree? Probably not. It's kind of like Republicans and Democrats today. You can look at the Congress, you can look at the Senate. They say, I'm on this side of the aisle, and I'm on this side of the aisle. So when a bill is brought forward, what often happens? All right, there's conflict. They say, you know, we're too far apart. We can't get anything done. We're a divided government. Sometimes I guess that's good, sometimes that's not. But are there not some bills, are there not some times where they say, we're going to work together on this? We are unified. You know, we're coming out. We do have our differences, and we're going to set those aside for this. So you do find that there are times or occasions in life where enemies, they're not going to become friends, but enemies will become what? They will work together for a common purpose. And when you start looking at the Pharisees and the Sadducees when it comes to Christianity, were they willing to work together? Yeah. They were. It's like, we've got to stop this because this is a threat to Judaism. So whether you're a Pharisee, whether you're a Sadducee, we do have Judaism in common. And if that goes under, we're in big trouble. We're going to lose what we have, and they certainly did not want that. So it's kind of interesting that you see that unity here as well. Anything that you want to add or ask before we talk about Paul voting against people? Okay, Paul says, when it came time for Christians, let's look at the end of verse 10. And when they were what? When they were put to death. Now, we don't have a lot of information about that. We think about Stephen in Acts chapter 7, but there's not a lot of information as far as, Paul's lifetime and Christians being persecuted by Jews to the point of death. But Paul does make that statement, and he says, when those times came, Paul says, what was at least part of my responsibility? I
cast my vote against
them. All right, I voted against them. I cast my vote against them. We'll say a little bit more in verse 11 as far as the word vote. But I will tell you here that the original word, the non-translated vote, described a little stone or described a little pebble. Now, we've probably never done this, but in ancient times they had, if you were going to, I think that there have been within the last 100 years some clubs that have done this. I know some guy clubs had been pictured in this way. Everybody gets a little marble. In ancient times, it would have been a pebble. You get a white pebble or marble, and you get a black pebble. You get a black marble. So you've got two, and maybe you're going to vote on a new member, or you're going to vote on something else, and then you have the information laid before you, and then you go and you put your marble or you put your stone in a box. And then they open up the box and they check them out. If everything is white, every stone, every marble is white, then what are they going to conclude?
You're approved.
All right. If it's a membership issue, everybody says you're good, so you're in. And if there is a black pebble or a black stone there, then guess what? All right, you've been blackballed. You know, you can kind of see the connection there. So you're probably not going to get in. If it were a jury situation, the jury comes up, and rather than going before the judge and saying, here's the verdict, and have the bailiff hand it over, if the judge opens up the box and you've got one black pebble or stone in there, then guess what? You've got one person who was voting guilty. The rest, of course, would have been voting that the person was innocent. So the word translated vote is going to, or the stone, rather, let's turn to that, is only used here and in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 17. Now, having said that, Paul says, I cast my vote against them. If we were to read the book of Acts and stop with the first few verses in Acts chapter 8, Paul, what's said about him at the end of Acts chapter 7? What was his activity as far as the death of Stephen? All right, he's there with the coats. He's kind of watching over the coats. So his involvement at that stage sounds where?
He was consenting.
Yeah, he was at least consenting to it. He's not on the front end of the persecution. He's not at the tip of the spear. It sounds like he's really interested, and he's definitely not the front man at that particular point in time. But now as we get a little further into the book, Acts chapter 26, would we say that his involvement went far past caring for clothes? It did. Now, we have to read a lot further to get that part of the story, but that is absolutely right. Anything else that you want to add or ask before we talk about the word saints? Brian?
It says when they were put to death, they cast a vote against them. So this shows more than just Stephen. I mean, plural.
Yeah.
So you've got multiple Christians.
That's how I read it. There's some people who try to get around that, and to me, those attempts are not very convincing. I think that you have to, especially when you look at what we talked about from verse 9, what we're going to see in verse 11 as far as his persecution as well. And it's probably a good thing that inspiration has not given us some additional details. It's like they went just to the right. They gave us just the right amount of information to kind of understand just how far Paul went without giving so many different points where we develop a negative picture of it.
And what's the motivation of people who would deny death?
I think that their view of Paul has been colored to the point by personal bias, where they just don't want to admit it. And I guess maybe part of the thinking is if you do acknowledge that, you do admit that this is what the text says, then you maybe in their minds open up Paul to, you know, maybe a life which can't be redeemed, you know, that he just went too far. But like I say, inspiration seems to take us to exactly the right point and say, here is a proper picture of what he did. We're just not going to give you a specific set of details. So you have all the lurid details.
But in Hebrews, whenever it goes to the chapter where it goes to people of faith and it tells how they were prosecuted, you can relate back that that has to be part of what was being done here. I mean, it isn't like it's he was living white, you know. If he was persecuting like he says he was here, some of that had to be also the way the people that he consented to have killed.
Yeah, you're very perceptive. I'm just going to say, let's shut you down for now until we get to verse 11, because that will add to exactly what you're saying.
I think the other thing interesting here is that when Jesus was taken to Pilate, it was for the death sentence. That's why they went there, because they didn't have the authority to convict someone of the death sentence. But something in the Jews' attitude has changed now about Christianity, because Paul was casting death votes against people.
Yeah. Well, sometimes people go further. They get excited, and they go further. I read about a shooting the other day that was in the news. A guy came in and threatened somebody, and the business owner returned fire. And then the business owner got a little too rambunctious. He's chasing the guy out the door, and the guy, as he's running down the street, the guy is still shooting at him. Well, that's obviously not something that you should do or can do. I mean, if you're chasing the guy out the door when he's fleeing for his life and you shoot him, chances are that now you have gone from being the defender to now you're the one who is, being the shooter. And whether you hit him or not, you're probably going to be charged with something. And if you kill him, you're probably, even though you were the victim, at least initially, you're probably going to be charged with murder. You just can't do that stuff. But why would somebody do that? The crime is over. I mean, he came in, tried to rob, and he's been repelled. And now the threat's running down the street. Why would the guy leave his shop, his place of safety, and chase the guy?
Adrenaline.
Well, I think adrenaline would definitely be part of that, but...
Anger.
Well, anger. And sometimes people can get carried away, can't they? I mean, he just gets so revved up, he thinks, I'm going to get you, you know? So you got to be careful with that stuff. And I think there may have been a little bit with Paul. All right, let's talk about holy for just a second. That is an adjective. It's found more than 200 times in the New Testament. And oftentimes it describes who or what is dedicated to God in a service. It's the word which is describing the Spirit, the Holy Spirit. It describes angels, prophets, God's covenant, God's law, God's people. Even Peter, 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, uses the word to describe God's people as a nation. It describes the church as far as the New Jerusalem, the great and holy city, Revelation chapter 21 and verse 10. So here, Paul uses that word to say many of the saints, many of the holy people he put in prisons, many of the holy people he did his very best to oppose. So you have Paul, he offends the holy God by persecuting his holy people as they did their holy work and they lived their holy lives. The world, if you listen to it, it often mocks, it often rejects the idea of holiness. I remember growing up, they used to talk about the holy rollers and some other people, and some of that stuff was deserved as far as people were not exactly holy as far as their worship and things, but this is a word which describes Christians, and it is an important biblical word. All right, let's see if we can get a little in as far as Acts chapter 26 and verse 11, because it continues the thought. Paul says, I punish them how often, where?
In every
synagogue. All right. All the synagogues, ASV, I punished them in all the synagogues, every synagogue. And it did that how often? I punished them frequently. I punished them often. And then he says, I strove to make them what? Blaspheme. And how did he feel? He says, I was
enraged.
All right, I like that translation. I was enraged. We'll say a little bit more about that. Anybody else?
Raging fury.
All right, that's even better. Raging fury. Now, when someone says he was furiously raging, or there was raging fury in his eyes and in his actions, what kind of impression does that leave you with?
Look out.
Yeah, it takes us back to the robber for just a bit, doesn't it? I mean, this guy, he is enraged. I mean, he is absolutely furious that somebody came into his shop and somebody tried to hold him up. And now he says, you came in, you did this to me, and what am I going to do to you? I've got this lead pipe and baseball bat, and what am I going to do? You remember the Q Club shooter? Did you see that? Did you see the fellow who did the shooting, what he looked like? Did you see the pictures when they brought him in? I mean, the guy's face is all roughed up. I mean, he looks bad. And the story I saw about the guy who attacked the Q Club shooter, he said, I just started wailing on him. You know, beat him with his gun and hit him with my fists and used my feet on him. And I mean, I'm just out there, I mean, just, you know, it sounded like he's just trying to kill him. So you would say that when someone is exceedingly mad, I mean, they are just pulling off the stops. They are not going to be willing to stop. So let's just make a couple quick points here. We can't get it all in. But let's talk about... the word which is translated be enraged. The New American Standard which we got is furiously enraged. Paul was like an angry, he was like a dangerous animal. Jackson made this point, and I almost mentioned this earlier. He says there is no fury comparable to that of a religious fanatic. Now, would you say that that's true? There is no fury comparable to that of a religious fanatic. But we can take it outside of the realm of religion and find fury. I mean, we've seen that with some school board meetings and some other things. But what about the person who is, let's say, a Muslim? They've got some very strong moral convictions, and they look at a nation, we'll just use America as an example, and they see America as the great harlot. How do they feel inside? They have hate, and they have anger, and they have rage. And what is that hate, anger, and rage fueling them to do? I'm going to do what? I'm going to go to the great harlot, and I'm going to...
Retribution.
All right. And that form of retribution is going to be what?
Yeah.
It's going to be death. And are they willing to die for their cause?
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, now the mom, obviously angry. You can have a lot of rage there, and I mean, she can, you know, just about get up to the 10 level as far as the blood pressure and... Okay, she can go to a 12. All right, we'll give her that. But the religious fanatic, the mom's probably, though, not willing to die. So the religious fanatic will... Well, no, I mean at the school board meeting. I mean, she would die for her kids. I don't think she's going to take the bullet at the school board meeting. But so anyway, I guess we can debate the finer points of that. But anyway, we do get the general idea as far as rage and how Paul felt. I mean, he was... Do you think he would have been willing to die for the cause? I mean, if he could have taken out a big... pillar, you know, taking out a few apostles, perhaps he would have said, hey, I can't get them all, but if I can get a third of the apostles, I'll give my life for them. All right, what do we have as far as comments? Carol? And then we'll take mom and see who else is there.
Okay.